Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. On Saturday, more than 30,000 people took to the streets of San Francisco to demand racial and economic justice, an end to fossil fuel production, and a just transition to 100% renewable energy. It was the largest climate mobilization the West Coast has ever seen. These demands were put to California Governor Jerry Brown ahead of the Global Climate Action Summit, which officially begins on Wednesday. Business executives and politicians from around the world will be here to talk about solutions to climate change. Many grassroots activists say the summit is too focused on market-based approaches that do not prioritize people on the front lines, especially people of color and indigenous communities. They say market-based solutions being touted at the summit, including carbon trading, serve a pro-corporate agenda. And they are holding their own gathering called Solidarity to Solutions, with a number of events planned this week. In fact, as we are speaking right now, I was just checking out a Facebook Live video. Indigenous peoples of the North and the South are trying to give an open letter to Jerry Brown at the governor's task force. Many people say that they will risk arrest. Joining us to talk about the march and this week's activities are two guests. Denise Abdul-Rahman is the Environmental and Climate Justice Chair for the Indiana NAACP. She's doing a lot of work in East Chicago, where decades of manufacturing have left lead and other toxins in the water and soil. Denise recently served as a grassroots global justice delegate to the COP21 climate change agreement in Paris. Hi, Denise. Thanks for coming in.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Maya Bahavaj. She is the It Takes Roots Coordinator at the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance. Maya started organizing schools in her hometown of Detroit and then worked in Chicago fighting the school-to-prison pipeline. She's done election organizing in Florida and Minnesota, anti-gentrification work in New York City, and she also was a student organizer in Paris, a health justice organizer in Cambodia. She supported farm workers in Argentina here in California, and in her homeland of India, she launched a national organizing firm to fight gender norms and gender violence, which included a Get Out the Vote campaign for women-friendly politicians. Maya, thank you for all of your amazing work, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. I want to ask you both about the march this weekend. Over 800 global events took place in 91 countries, including 260-plus in the United States, across almost 50 states, and massive, massive turnout here in San Francisco. People say it was the biggest climate march the West Coast has ever seen. Maya, what was the experience like for you on the streets?
It was a really beautiful space to see the leadership of our Black and Brown and Indigenous comrades really be spotlighted and lifted up. We're often sidelined by folks who are thought of as traditional environmentalists, folks talking about saving polar bears and, strapping their bodies to trees, which are all important pursuits, but often the everyday plight that people of color go through, both in the global north as well in the global south, is overshadowed. And it was a really special space to see that immediate concern and that work lifted up right now.
You just said that we're often sidelined, and we've done so many shows about the environmental movement, which has many different factions. Do you think that the more mainstream movement has done a better job of reaching out to communities of color, indigenous communities, low-income communities?
I would say rather than them doing a better job, I think they're listening to the very powerful work that indigenous Black and Brown communities have been leading forever. And so rather than being unresponsive to the true work that's happening on the ground that's led by the grassroots, they're realizing, wow, these people have a strategy here that works, and that's important and we need to listen to.
Very good distinction. Denise, what about you? What was your experience like this weekend?
Well, I was more in a supportive role. I've been active in the It Takes Roots for several years, starting with the COP21 experience. But it was beautiful to see the frontline communities leading, as Maya said, and that these are the groups that should be resourced to do this work, because we are the communities with the solutions and the answers. And it starts with equity, and it starts from the ground up with the Jemez principles, with bottom-up organizing. organizing, including everyone and letting people speak for themselves. And so for those that have supported that, you know, they're commended for that, but that's really where it should be to begin with.
And do you, what are your thoughts about environmental groups listening to Indigenous groups and groups of color? How have you seen that change over the years?
Well, I've participated with a lot of different national and Midwest regional organizing, and they're starting to really work well as it relates to, like, figuring out how to have a memorandum of understanding on what equity is, a memorandum of understanding on what just transition is, and listening to all of the various environmental justice groups across the nation and the globe so that they can include that and understand it better. But it still, to me, goes back to a lot of the resources, and I believe that a lot of the environmental justice groups should be highly funded to do the work. A lot of times we are asked to participate in a lot of these various things and share the knowledge, while the big green groups are funded to actually then implement the work or co-opt the narratives and things of that nature. So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done there. But I think basically, you know, they're starting to move in the right direction.
This is kind of a big question, but I'd like you both to talk about where we are right now. There's so much happening so quickly. I was just getting a breaking news alert about, I'm reading right now from USA Today, a coastal North Carolina county issued a mandatory evacuation for its entire population as Hurricane Florence strengthened to a Category 4 storm and continued its slow but angry dance toward the U.S. East Coast. So an entire coastal North Carolina county is being evacuated. This is mandatory. I mean, this is just the changes that we are seeing right before our eyes are really intense. I mean, even here, I'm glad actually over the weekend your air quality was much better than it's been over the last couple of weeks. But because of all the fires we've had red alert air quality. People who are older, people who have health concerns are being asked not to go outside. I mean, this is just two examples of so many things. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a huge question, Maya, but how do you see, I mean, where, how do you explain where we are right now?
I think we're seeing the symptoms of capitalism run rampant and an unsustainable, extractive, corporation-centric economic model that falls on the backs of people, most generally, who are Black and Brown and Indigenous, who are working class, who are queer, women, folks on the front lines of all of these struggles. And I think it's important to recognize that climate change is not abstracted. You know, folks maybe agree that it's human created, but it's linked and inextricably tied with our economic system. So, you know, we're seeing the effects of capitalism in the deportation and private prison model, in prison labor fighting wildfires, in gentrification and greenwashed housing plans, as well as the natural disasters that our folks are experiencing across the world and especially in the global south. So I think we're seeing the effects of an economy potentially on the brink of collapse. And that's why for us, centering around a model of just transition to a regenerative economy, to a cooperative economy, to an economy that recognizes and respects the balance between humans and the earth that we live on is so crucial. And that centering those frames of knowledge, Indigenous-led knowledge, Black-led knowledge, global-led, South-led knowledge, is so critical for us to really divest from a colonized mentality when it comes to any of the work that we do.
Denise, what would you add?
I would add that we're seeing the symptoms of the immorality, the dismissive or some other political agenda, the they should feel obligated to act, to change and utilize what we call our energy democracy platform, which is a vision for our nation's role and responsibility toward energy systems that address climate change, that changes it in a way that tackles the domestic and global inequality. And energy democracy in its truest sense moves us beyond the current government managed and operated systems to community at scale and shifts us from the corporate and centralized fossil fuel economy to one that is governed by our communities, one that lifts and protects communities' environment, their health, and their well-being.
Let's talk about what's happening this week. There is the Global Climate Action Summit, which is being co-hosted by California Governor Jerry Brown. It officially begins on Wednesday, but a number of things are taking place starting today. Business executives from a number of corporations, including like Starbucks and Salesforce, will be here. Politicians from around the world will be here. And right before we started the show, I got an email from McDonald's saying that McDonald's Robert Gibbs, who used to work for the Obama administration and now works for McDonald's, will be here to talk about McDonald's sustainability efforts. So let's just talk about these events that are focused on climate change. This is not the first. There's so many like this. And these corporations come in and talk about what they're doing to be green. Maya, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we talked about the term greenwashing already, and I think that is the perfect description of what's happening right now, which is, you know, corporations use the same sort of strategies that they've always been using, profit-oriented, bottom-line-oriented, non-people-oriented systems, and put a facade of being green-friendly. That you see that in straws being banned in cities when we're still some of the largest emitters within all of those cities that are falling on the backs of people of color. You mentioned that Jerry Brown is co-hosting this summit. I think one thing that's really important to know is the other co-hosts of the summit are Michael Bloomberg, who, you know, rezoned swaths of New York City, which is where I live and organize right now, to push out people of color and encourage hyper-capitalist business zones that are some of the largest emitters and also are you know, whitewashing as well as greenwashing the city of New York. Anand Mahindra is also a co-host of the Global Climate Action Summit. Mahindra is one of the most unsafe, most malevolent corporations that operates in my home country of India. And they are not only a huge emitter, but have some of the worst worker policies you could imagine. They're consistently pushing indigenous Adivasi and Dalit folks out of their homelands. You know, it's almost not even trying to cover up that this is a corporate trade show. It's not a summit about climate at all. It's a way to talk about how can we maximize profit but make it sound good. And we see that not just in climate, but like I said, across issues when we're talking about how do we weaponize our police forces in the name of law and order and make that sound good, like we're protecting Americans from terrorism when really we're targeting black and brown folks in our own homes.
What kind of company is Mahindra?
Mahindra is a global, like, multinational conglomerate in India. So there's three major corporations, Tata, Mahindra, and a third, and they kind of each have a monopoly on all different industries throughout India. They create everything from dishwashers to cars to plastics to oil and lots of other things.
And the CEO is one of the co-sponsors of the summit.
Yes, that's correct. Okay. He also owns the most expensive single-family home in the world.
Wow. Denise, what are your thoughts about these kinds of summits that have a big corporate element to them?
Well, I agree with everything that Maya just lifted up, and would add that as it relates to one McDonald's and our other corporations like it, it's very disheartening and discouraging, especially corporations like McDonald's that really have a large base of frontline communities that work for them, and to not have a realization as they did their assessment and decided to come with their announcement, you know, what processes included people of color, people that work for their corporations in these decisions that are being made on behalf of our communities. This is a company that, you know, is employing technology that is eliminating jobs within their restaurant, you know. And so they should be looking at their definition of sustainability. Sustainability should also include equity in it and justice and, you know, that narrative of sustainability and inclusive of how they're going to justly transition their employees and the communities in which they serve. So for them to announce that they're a part of this shows to me a lack of, you know, full 360-degree assessment along with other corporations like them. And the GCAS or the Global Climate Action Summit is also, you know, very discouraging because, yes, it's a whole group of folks that are creating false solutions, geotechnological solutions that are not good for our communities, such as in the state of Indiana. There's a lot of talk around the carbon capture sequester, which is something that goes in, captures carbon and places it into the ground, which eventually is going to resurface itself. You know, different decisions around using nuclear, and those are not, you know, good for our communities. And so, right, they should have the people that are most impacted, the people that have been founders of the environmental justice community for many, many years should have and should be front and center at these discussions.
And do either of you know, are any grassroots activists, organizations taking part in any of these discussions officially?
So for the entirety of what they're terming civil society, which is essentially anybody that's connected to the work on the ground, the membership of the conference is around 5,000. As far as I can tell, they've capped the tickets for this, you know, air quotes, civil society group to under 500. So, and that's for the entire globe. So yes, you know, maybe there's 500 folks who are being let in to this conference organized by corporations, but you can imagine that with such a small number proportionally of folks from across the world, that's a cherry-picked list of who they decide they want to let in and who they don't. And quite frankly, the tickets are really opaque. Many of our members who have been leading the work on the ground are still unclear about whether they're going to be let in to this conference or not. And that's truly why we have organized this People Summit, this soul-to-soul week of action, because it's obvious, even in the design of registration for this conference, that it's not for us.
And I would add, I'm one of those people that's not really sure. I was told I was invited. I have something that says I was invited, but it says you're supposed to get one more thing, and I haven't received that one more thing. So I'm not sure if I'm going to be let in or not let in. And then I want to add that, at least from my experience, it was not like a direct from the Global Climate Action Summit itself. It was another organization or network that acted as a conduit and stepped back to support the environmental justice groups, which, I mean, that's commendable for the networks, but there should have been direct invitations to environmental justice organizations.
Mm-hmm. Denise Abdul-Rahman is the Environmental and Climate Justice Chair for the Indiana NAACP. She's doing a lot of work in East Chicago, where decades of manufacturing have left lead and other toxins in the water and the soil. We're also joined today by Maya Bahavaj. She is the It Takes Roots Coordinator at the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance. Maya has done so much organizing. She organized schools in her hometown of Detroit, then worked in Chicago fighting the school-to-prison pipeline. Today, we are talking about climate solutions from the grassroots. On Saturday, more than 30,000 people took to the streets of San Francisco to demand an end to fossil fuel production and a just transition to 100% renewable energy, also racial and economic justice. It was the largest climate mobilization the West Coast has ever seen. And these demands were put to California Governor Jerry Brown ahead of the Global Climate Action Summit. And if you took part in the march on Saturday, if you're taking part in any of the events that have been put together by Solidarity to Solutions, we'd love to hear from you. If you're planning to go to the Global Climate Action Summit, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts? 866-798-8255. With so much attention on the national picture right now, I mean, I was just talking about what's happening in case you missed it. A coastal North Carolina county has issued a mandatory evacuation order for its entire population as Hurricane Florence strengthened to a Category 4 storm. This is an entire county is being told to evacuate. So what are your thoughts about what is happening at this moment? We're seeing massive change happen right before our eyes. In many cases, it's affecting so many people around the globe. What are your thoughts about actions? 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. How is your community standing up and calling on 100% renewable energy? Denise, just briefly, you talked about getting a ticket to the Global Action Climate Action Summit. What strikes you about the lineup there? I mean, they've got a beautiful website. There's so many things taking place. Tons of speakers, celebrities, politicians from around the world, CEOs. What are you planning to do if you go, and what strikes you most about the event?
Haven't quite decided how we plan to participate. I do know that we will want to lift up the energy democracy principles, which are related to our human rights, our need to have our self-determination, indicate what we as communities want as our source of energy, our ability to insert how energy should be used, how energy should be a common for our communities. So we'll be employing and advocating and negotiating some of our energy democracy principles, either with the folks that represent the formal civil society and or being able to directly speak with the political officials and or business officials that are within the arena.
Maya, do you know of anyone who's planning to go and what strategies they plan to use?
Yeah, I think we have a combination of strategies. We're working with allies who are going to be on the inside, academics who are supporting work from folks on the front lines, and also a small contingent of folks from It Takes Roots itself who have, like Denise, managed to obtain tickets to participate. And, you know, I think we're looking at this from a number of lenses. Sure, there are corporations on the ground who probably are not going to be persuadable, and instead who we need to target to show that their work is just greenwashing. But there are also government officials and other members from different ranks of civil society who are going to be attending the Global Climate Action Summit who are persuadable, who are folks who look at the website of the GCAS and notice that there are Indigenous members participating and think, oh, I must be doing a good thing. So we're participating on the inside to really appeal to those folks and show, hey, if you truly want to do what you said you're here to do, which is both transition to a clean and sustainable economy and environment, but also support folks on the front lines, you need to be divesting from these frameworks of conferences and instead paying attention to the work that we're doing, that folks from Etiks Roots are doing. So we're asking all of those registered for the Global Climate Action Summit to attend our Solidarity to Solutions Summit, the People Summit, the day before, where we'll actually be paralleling the four themes of the GCAS, but talking about them from the lens of what's actually real. So the GCAS is talking about land stewardship. And so we have a theme that's talking about protecting the earth and the land that we live on, because it's not just about stewarding the land, it's about how do we actually be in harmony with the places where we're living. They have a, just like Denise mentioned, they have a theme on creating healthy energy economies. And so instead we're talking about energy democracy. How do we collectivize those decisions? So we're really appealing to all those folks who want to be on the right side, and we're asking them, which side are you on? We need you to be on our side, and that we're not here to be traded. We need you to listen to us directly.
And if you'd like to find more information about all of the events taking place this week and more information about Solidarity to Solutions, you can head over to yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about participants with Solidarity to Solutions. This is an incredibly large group that is in San Francisco holding a number of events this week, and they're focused on energy democracy and a just transition to 100% renewable energy as California Governor Jerry Brown gets ready to kick off the Global Climate Action Summit in San Francisco. And today we are joined by Maya Bahavaj, the It Takes Roots coordinator at the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance, Denise Abdul-Rahman, environmental and climate justice chair for the Indiana NAACP. And now I would like to welcome Daryl Molina Sarmiento, executive director of Communities for a Better Environment. CBE builds local power through community organizing in a number of cities, including Oakland and Richmond. Thank you so much for joining us, Daryl.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to see you.
So we were
talking about the Saturday climate march. People are saying that it's one of the largest climate marches the West Coast has ever seen. What really struck you about taking part in the march?
It was a very powerful showing of our communities coming together from all around the world. For CBE, we organize in East Oakland and in Richmond here in the Bay Area and in Southern California, in Southeast Los Angeles and Wilmington. And it was a powerful opportunity for us to bring our membership together from all across the state to join in this huge, historic mobilization for climate jobs and justice.
And we should say that people from all over the world came here.
Absolutely.
People from the Amazon, a number of tribes across the country.
Yes, it was, we've been able to participate in the various Solidarity to Solutions Summit events where we've been able to see and meet the indigenous leaders from all across the country, all across the state, and all across the world that are fighting, you know, this extractive economy in their local communities, in their local towns that, you know, we're also seeing here locally in California.
I was listening to Democracy Now! Because they're broadcasting all week from the summit, and someone, and I don't remember the name, but said Standing Rock is just continuing.
Exactly. What we're seeing on the ground in Wilmington, part of the city of Los Angeles, are plans to expand refineries and bring in crude oil from the Bakken crude oil from North Dakota, tar sands from Canada, to be refined here in California, to be refined in our refineries in Rodeo, in Richmond, in Wilmington, in Los Angeles.
So they're actually going to be refined in Los Angeles.
Exactly. That's what the plans are, is to bring this crude oil. And we know that this oil is highly corrosive, and it's this type of oil that leads to the deterioration of the pipes in our oil refineries. We're here not only to protect our communities, but also the workers that are on the front lines and our family that live on the front lines of these refineries. And when we see more of this extractive oil, this crude oil, corrosive oil in these pipes, this is what leads to explosions such as the Chevron refinery explosion that happened in 2012.
What is the status of that project?
Well, you know, what's happening since then is our communities have continued to rise up because we still continue to see refinery expansions, and we still continue to see our frontline communities that are being held as sacrifice zones in the midst of all of this. But our communities in Richmond, for example, are fighting for a just transition, and we formed a coalition to work with the local groups to envision what that can look like for communities that, you know, have refineries in their backyard.
Can you all talk about just when you have meetings and gatherings and you decide what's most effective and where to really put your efforts, because so much is happening at the same time and it's really hard to keep up. Hurricanes, fires, floods, you know, we're losing our coral reefs, overfishing. I mean, the list is so extremely long and it's pretty daunting. How do you determine, I mean, what I think is so amazing and positive is various groups coming together. Like when I was listening to some of the speeches, you had the labor groups speaking. You had people talking about police violence. You had such a wide range, which is amazing. How do you decide what strategies are most effective?
Well, one Darryl. Thing I just wanted to comment is that what we're facing on the ground in our communities, we're in the communities with the highest concentration of oil refineries. So we have the refineries. We also have the oil extraction happening in our communities. We see freeway expansion happening. And we also see this green infrastructure that's also not reaching us. It's not reaching the communities most impacted. So we're doing a lot of it. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to fight on these multiple fronts to bring justice for our communities.
And if I may,
Maya.
One of the key reasons that we are here as an alliance of alliances, as It Takes Roots, is that we believe in the power of formations that bring our folks together across the country, across Turtle Island, and across the world. And the way that we make decisions is truly a collective, people-oriented process. We are working from the leadership of the grassroots, from the leadership of women. We're really seeing a feminist, grassroots feminist-oriented politic, where instead of decisions being made by a charismatic leader from the top down, we are sourcing all of that knowledge together, and we're coming together in this week and in other formations to share our strategies about work. So, for example, if I can share one thing that's happening right now, is that we have a local action that's taking place at the GCF, a small group of folks who are preparing for the Global Climate Action Summit. And at the following the leadership of our local Indigenous grandmothers, Idle No More SF Bay, we have part of our contingent there delivering a letter to the governor in person saying, this GCF is a sham. We don't support red, and we need to be listening to grassroots leaders. While at the same time, we have other local leaders who are doing work in other parts of the country or the world, or preparing for this, you know, multi-issue movement in other ways. So we're really coming together from the grassroots, from a grassroots feminist perspective, in order to decide what those strategies are.
I love that. When will that be out?
The letter?
Yeah.
We'll be releasing it probably in the next hour.
Oh, wow. Okay. We'll look for that. What would you add, Denise?
Well, similar to Darryl, you know, in the state of Indiana, we have cities like Indianapolis, Gary, East Chicago, Fort Wayne, and many of us are fighting for our own various plights. So in our case, many of our communities are over-policed and have a lot of large amounts of violence, and resources seem to stop at a certain street and community and all of the gentrification. And then our communities are the ones that are hosting all all of the toxins and all of the power plants. And so it makes our communities more vulnerable, particularly to all of the impacts of climate change, whether it be the increasing of the agricultural yield and the food deserted communities and their ability to gain access, as well as not really seeing the affordability or access to this green infrastructure because we're not a part of those various conversations. So many of our strategies are, it's really all of above, everything from trying to educate and support the empowerment of our communities to doing advocacy on policy. And now you have to kind of decentralize because Indiana is a very conservative state, so it's pretty rare that we can get any type of legislative policies passed. Most of the time we're in a defensive mode. We did win a victory on a House Bill 1320 that sought to charge a fee to distribute energy, and we were able to stop that. And there was a narrative about how people of color were going to not benefit from distributive energy being free, and we debunked that narrative as an organization of people of color. But we do everything from trying to build it, you know, have real tangible examples in our community to supporting the empowerment to fighting in our state houses. And then we appreciate the It Takes Roots and the Climate Justice Alliance because it reminds us that we're not alone, that we're all fighting all over the nation and the globe for our right to, you know, have a just transition and to exist in a healthy living communities and to be treated equitably and just.
Denise Abdul-Rahman is the Environmental and Climate Justice Chair for the Indiana NAACP. Maya Bahavaj is the It Takes Roots Coordinator at the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance. And Daryl Molina Sarmiento is Executive Director of Communities for a Better Environment. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions for our guests, any comments, what are your thoughts about where we are right now? If you are a climate activist, if you're taking part in any of the events this week, or if you took part in the massive march on Saturday, what really stood out for you? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And let's hear from Greg in Redwood City. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I just wanted to say I really appreciate their efforts, and I actually have launched a project called Plant Tomorrow, where I go out to the communities and plant redwood trees to sequester carbon. And you know, I've kind of gone to different you know, areas down in the Bay Area, and there's a big learning curve with people that, you know, have access to, you know, more economic freedom. They have the time to take, you know, take off to help with projects. They have, you know, money to donate. We can go to other communities. You know, when you're trying to struggle to put food on the table, you don't really have that time to, you know, and to donate or to volunteer or to do a lot of the other things. So I kind of feel like there's a lot of learning curve and also just lack of opportunity to access, you know, projects like mine because of money. And it's really unfortunate. And I don't, I think kind of a lot of the grassroots movements kind of run into that, that same problem where, you know, the community that needs basically a voice can't participate because of economic reasons, and it's kind of very frustrating in a lot of ways. And, you know, so then you have the next generation that hasn't been tapped into accessing, you know, like volunteer opportunities and don't really understand the value of that, and it's just kind of one of the most frustrating parts of the Prime Project.
Yeah, Greg, I mean, on so many levels, especially in the Bay Area where it's so incredibly expensive to live. Who would like to comment on that? Daryl?
Yeah, that's definitely the case, especially in the communities in which we organize in. You know, folks are working. These meetings happen when students are in school. But, you know, what we've seen is that the reality is on the ground is that folks don't have a choice. Sometimes they have to continue to fight for their families so that they don't have to continue to bring their children to emergency rooms because of asthma attacks in the middle of the night. You know, that's just the reality on the ground, is that, you know, people end up making those sacrifices to be there and to show up.
Denise?
Many times we call ourselves, you know, we'll make a statement that we are representing or speaking for those that were unable to be here because they have to work, they have to, you know, do whatever it is that they have to do. And so we make sure that it's not just our voice alone, but that we are speaking for many, many of our community. And then we do try to engage those that might be available, and we are very specific when we sometimes engage for resources, that we make sure that there are stipends and things like that available to resource our community that many times may be underemployed or unemployed, so that they're not always in this volunteer capacity, even though it speaks to the core of their essence and their livability. And so we just try to advocate in that way to try to support so that they can be at the various different tables to speak for themselves.
Yeah, and I think the beauty of a grassroots organizing model is that instead of creating third spaces where these decisions happen, we're taking it to those primary two spaces that folks are operating in. We're having meetings around the kitchen table. We're meeting with workers at their factories. We're recognizing that domestic labor is a politic that's also involved in environmental struggle, that workers' rights are also environmental rights, and that we can't separate the two. And so instead of asking, why aren't folks showing up, we should be asking, why aren't we going to where people are already?
Well, thank you for calling in, Greg. And if you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have a long email about the importance of electric cars and getting people off of fossil fuels for transportation. That's important, but it's also not accessible to a lot of people. Electric cars are still very expensive. And also, if you're renting, it's really hard to charge it because you don't have a garage to put the car in, right?
Right. That's something we have been working on in Indiana, or at least trying to advocate for policies that make electric vehicles more affordable. Mm-hmm. Not having it be one of these like credit card or monthly payment plans that you have to sign up for on the internet. We've indicated that this does not make it equitable and accessible to our communities. We have these blue Indy cars that are taking up space on all the streets everywhere and in our urban communities, and yet none of us are utilizing these vehicles. And so there are think tanks and conversations that are occurring. We've also been participants with the Volkswagen settlement, and in Indiana we gained over $41 million of that settlement, and we've said that our communities are the ones that are most impacted by highway air pollution, and so we've said that there should be they set criteria for how this money could be used, and one of them is electric vehicle buses, and we said that urban public school systems should be the ones to benefit from these electric vehicle buses, and that we should get a large proportion of that settlement in the state of Indiana. So, yes, we are fighting for equitable access to electric vehicles in our communities.
And we're fighting for a decarbonization of our transportation system overall, and that includes personal vehicles and zero emission technology for the goods movement, for the trains, for the freeways that continue to expand and pollute our communities. And we are fighting for access also for these vehicles, because we know that there has been a lot of movement around decarbonization of our grid, but where are we at around transportation, and how are communities accessing that? And so we have to fight for those rebates. We have to fight for those systems that we can trade in our old cars so that we can actually access a clean air vehicle. We have to fight for those programs that renters can, so that we can actually build charging stations, public charging stations in our communities, so that our folks can have access to this.
It's such a good point. And Maya, you said you live in New York, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because of incredible activism from taxi drivers and a number of people who are affected by companies like Uber and Lyft. They were able to fight successfully for a limit on the number of cars that can be on the streets at any given time. And I just wonder, because Denise and Maya, you're from out of the city, you're not from here, it's pretty amazing what you see downtown, because on any given day, we've got 40,000 of these cars on our roads, which are contributing to pollution and so many of these problems that we have.
Yes, that's right. And I think Denise and Daryl spoke about the importance of not just electric personal vehicles, but electric or sustainable public transportation models. Because, you know, we're seeing that in a country that doesn't invest in public transportation, you have a proliferation of rideshare systems that are huge emitters, that are inaccessible, that are actually unsafe, both for workers and folks who are taking them. And so we need to be thinking about how are we creating systems of transit that are accessible and public and viewed as part of the common good.
Right.
So in New York specifically, we're investing a lot in how do we support the subway and bus infrastructure to be green and accessible so that we don't need to rely only upon ride shares and that we're not undermining the taxi workers who have fought for workers' rights for so long.
Yeah, and I should say that Uber and Lyft drivers also fought for that cap.
Yes.
Because they're having such a hard time making ends meet, driving long, long hours in many cases just to get a ride. I want to ask you all, where you think we are right now in terms of the political movement, because, well, our political situation, I should say. We did a show last week about what happens to environmental law and the environment if Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed to the Supreme Court. And it's very, environmentalists say it's very, very daunting. A lot of these laws that activists say do not go far enough could be wiped out. So what are your thoughts on that, Daryl? And also just, you know, there seems to be something moves forward, something gets pulled back, right? You see these progressive candidates winning in some of these cities across the country. It's just such a, that the time that we're in, there's so many things going on at once.
Well, I'm always reminded, and I also like to remind myself during these times of utter chaos in our political climate, that, you know, what we're seeing now is, it's new, but it's also not new. Mm-hmm. You know, our communities have faced oppressive leadership, oppressive regimes in our home countries, here in the United States, elected leaders, officials that represent big oil, that, you know, don't, you know, protect the communities that they serve. We've seen that, and we continue to resist. In Los Angeles, we're taking on big oil. We are taking on folks, and we're bringing on lawsuits against these multinational corporations, against agencies, and against governments that unfortunately are denying the reality that our communities face on the ground. And we're going to continue to take them on. And we've seen the success of that. We've seen the success of these legal challenges. And, you know, even given this administration, we're going to continue to fight.
Mm-hmm. Denise?
Right. Let's see. A couple years ago, I think, we participated with Climate Justice Alliance. I helped to organize what was called the Our Power campaign. And we galvanized a lot of us from the Region 5 area of the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. And we submitted what we called at the time Our Power Plan to insert some of our narratives as it related to the Clean Power Plan. And so I think the strategies are the same as we contend with this administration and this new, soon-to-be, if he's not already confirmed, Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh, that we will deploy local ordinances and deploy local activism and share and lift up what we want for our communities and try to fight back the best we can. In like East Chicago, they had Pruitt at the time came and visited East Chicago all at the same time when he was rolling back the Clean Air Act. impact and impacting that community. And we did activism and we engaged them and we submitted petitions and things of that nature. And so we'll continue that type of activism. And lastly, the NAACP nationally then has a campaign of Stop Kavanaugh and encouraging folks to call their senators at 844-899-9913 to take action to stop Kavanaugh from being confirmed, if possible.
And I've read that the vote is sometime either later this month or October 1st.
Not sure.
Not sure, yeah. What about you, Maya?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one of the things that are so important about working through a framework of just transition is that we are not just envisioning how we react or fight the current policies that exist, but how do we also really take steps to create a better world? How are we envisioning what we want our communities to look like right now and putting that into action? So like Denise and Daryl mentioned, we're investing in local action and local alternative systems just as much as we're fighting what's happening on the national level. So, you know, we're creating programs for education, for urban farming, for systems that are around language justice that allow our folks to be in communities that are strong and powerful, no matter what comes down from the pipeline at a national level.
What else are you all looking forward to this week? We have about 2 minutes left. I was just talking about Indigenous groups facing arrest to give an open letter to Jerry Brown and the governor's takes force is what they're calling that. There's a number of things going on this week. Nonviolent direct action against climate change profiteers today, solidarity solutions tomorrow, and then when the official conference kicks off on Wednesday, there's going to be mass nonviolent direct actions. What else are you all taking part in this week?
Yeah, we're really, really excited about the Soul to Soul Summit that's happening tomorrow. That'll be from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. at La Raza Park, which is also called Potrero del Sol in the Mission on Cesar Chavez Street. This park itself is an example of people's solutions and organizing to turn a plot of land into a home for the community. So we'll be honoring that space and honoring Ohlone land by conducting these workshops on themes that I talked about, taking them back from the Global Climate Action Summit and centering them in people's language. But also we'll be dancing and listening to music and singing together. We'll have a concert portion. We'll be eating amazing food from local food trucks who are nourishing our bellies and, you know, showing what a model of food justice is. And then we'll have this huge, amazing art-filled direct action on the 13th that'll be starting at 8 a.m. at the steps of the Global Climate Action Summit in Jesse Square, the Yerba Buena Gardens. And it'll be a safe action for families as well as including an element of risk for those who want to participate in that, and really going to be a celebration of this new world that we want to come about. And so I encourage everybody to come out to those 2 days on the 11th, that's Tuesday, and the 13th, that's Thursday.
And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That is Maya Bahavaj. She is the It Takes Roots Coordinator at the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance. Denise Abdul-Rahman is the Environmental and Climate Justice Chair for the Indiana NAACP. And Daryl Molina Sarmiento is Executive Director of Communities for a Better Environment. Maya, Denise, and Daryl, thank you all for your great work, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. Check yourcallradio.org for more information. Thanks to Andrew Seltzer for producing today's show. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.